Hi, everybody. It's Sharon Hall, and I am here today with Dr. Ben Allen and his wife, Carrie Allen. Carrie is a care partner to her dad, who has behavior variant FTD, and she is an advocate for FTD and a board member of the Hotshot Challenge. I'm sure some of you were involved in the Hotshot Challenge in the past. And they are now becoming a nonprofit, and they will be benefiting support for FTD families and for research. So that's something new for Carrie. And Dr. Ben Allen is a data analyst whose goal is to sort of cut down on that, ease the pain of the diagnosis journey of FTD. And we'll be talking to Ben in just a few. We're going to let Carrie start it off. So, Carrie, tell us a little bit about the Hotshot Challenge and how it came about and where it's going.
Well, hey, Sharon, thank you so much for asking us to be on here. It's just been such a joy chatting with you and getting to know you and getting to be on your podcast. It's such a privilege. So we started the FTD Hotshot Challenge was started by a group of ladies who are all affected by FTD in one way, form, or the other. And we were all very passionate about using our presence, especially on social media, to raise awareness about FTD, to let people know what it is, to let people know that it exists, that it's not Alzheimer's disease, that it's different than the typical, you know, FTD patients do look a lot different than what you would typically think of with a dementia patient. And we wanted people to know that, and we wanted to have a fun community-based way for people to participate in to raise awareness about that. So during World FTD Awareness every year, it's now an annual event on social media where in the fall, which this year it will be the week starting September 26th, we all go on social media. We record ourselves taking a shot of hot sauce, which is always fun. And we record ourselves taking that shot of hot sauce, and we post it to our social media with an explanation of what FTD is. And we all take our shots together to raise awareness for FTD. And it's just been so fun. We've been able to raise several hundred thousand dollars over the last couple of years, to benefit just different FTD related causes. And we're really excited to be branching out this year, kind of on our own, doing our own thing, being able to invest a little bit more in the advocacy and awareness projects, as well as being able to support several FTD research related organizations as well. So it's been a lot of fun being on that team, and it's a great group of gals. I love working with them, and we're really excited for the 2022 challenge.
Sounds good. And you've changed a little bit on that because you're now becoming your own nonprofit. Is that right?
Yeah, in the past, we've kind of just been a grassroots movement. We kind of wanted to see if it had sticking power. You know how it is when you try something new. You want to make sure the community is there for it. You want to make sure it's really meeting a need. And we've really, really been blown away by the community's participation and their giving and donations. It's just been phenomenal. So I think we're at the point now where we've done this 2 years in the past. We started it in 2020 in the midst of the pandemic. And it seems like interest has continued past that. So we're ready to, form our own organization and kind of take the next step in making it a little bit more formal so we can do a bit more than we have been able to in the past with the funds and with the awareness that we raise. So we're pretty excited.
So you mentioned that you wanted some of it to go to research. You also want to help families. Is the helping the families part of the research, or are you going to have some separate program for families?
We will be not emphasizing the fundraising aspect of the challenge as much this year as we have in years past. We're trying to pivot a little bit more towards the advocacy and the awareness side of things. But we will still be doing a bit of fundraising, and any of those funds that we raise, we will be then giving to organizations that we feel share our vision for supporting FTD care partners and supporting research grants or clinical trials, anything like that. I don't want to name any names yet because we haven't quite finalized who our exact beneficiaries will be, but rest assured, any of the funds that we raise will go directly toward FTD awareness raising efforts and FTD research organizations.
And Carrie, I know you do a lot with online with media. Yes. Is that what drove you to do this Hotshot Challenge to begin with? Is that you knew how to use media?
Well, yeah, one of my side jobs, what I do with my daytime hat is I do social media marketing. And I actually got together with our founder, who is Amanda Dawson, lovely, lovely person, who is also very passionate about FTD awareness. And we got talking and we were just kind of swapping our stories of being care partners for our fathers back and forth. And she and I shared a frustration with just the lack of awareness. And we'd seen other efforts that raised awareness for other diseases, kind of like the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge, which you've probably heard of. And Amanda was kind of like, why can't we do that for FTD? Why not us, you know? And so we asked around and gathered a little bit of interest from the community and saw who else was interested in doing that and formed our little team. And the rest is, as they say, is history. And yeah, I help with the social media side of things. We've had different ladies over the years help with different aspects of the challenge, but usually the social media side of things is more what I'm involved in. And I really love it. It's a great way to raise people's awareness of the disease, to be able to educate people about it. And I love what I do for them. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Any advocacy is good. I mean, no matter who, I always say that even if you're advocating in the grocery line, that counts.
Hey,
you don't have to do big things to advocate. All you have to do is tell your story to one other person and you're advocating.
Exactly. And that's exactly what we wanted to do with the challenge, is just give people an opportunity to share their stories, even if it is just with their little circle of social media friends and family. You know, it gives them an opportunity to talk about it. And that's what we're really passionate about.
Yeah. And, you know, I always say our stories matter.
Yes.
Experts, even the professionals in the field will tell you that when they hear the stories of people with FTD, they are so much more moved than getting a lecture on FTD. So, because the stories are what matters, it makes it human. And I think it's really important to highlight stories. So I'm glad you're taking that slant on it and, going for the stories and let people know how FTD affects a family, because it is a family affair. You know, I recently spoke and I said, and Rod spoke with me and I said, you know, there are not two of us. There's one of us in this FTD together. We are together in this FTD. You can't do it alone. And he can't do it alone. So we are one. And you don't talk to one of us without talking to the other one. We're always there together. So I salute you and trying to get advocacy out. I always look for younger people because I'm getting to be a little bit old, a little bit long in the tooth. And I'm looking forward to someday having a retirement. So I'm always eager to have young advocates come aboard and push FTD. So Ben, I would like to kind of get you in here as well. You have a unique slant on this, and tell us how you got involved with FTD and why it's so important to you and what you've done with it.
Yeah, sure. So that's awesome being on here, Sharon. Thank you so much for the opportunity. And I think the Algernon Project really was from just the diagnosis journey that Carrie and I walked through with my father-in-law. And so it was just quite a journey. We had no idea. And misdiagnosis left and right? I mean, it's just such a rare thing and people don't know about it. The awareness isn't there, as we've been saying. And so as a guy that likes data a lot and seeing how this diagnosis journey went, it kind of was an inspiration for me to think, you know, surely there's a way to use data and to use these images to make this process less painful. So I was obsessed with, I still am obsessed with it, but you know, it really took a lot of my mind share for all the free time I had for a number of years there, where I was just diving into the images, figuring out what was going on with how they were structured, what the images looked like when people did have atrophy versus normal imaging and normal images. And the approach that I came up with was a pretty simple approach. It's a volumetric approach, and it works. But I think as we've been focusing on the project and trying to move it along, we've begun to realize that the real trick is getting hospital systems to adopt any sort of volumetric approach that would shed a light on atrophy that may be abnormal. And because it is subtle, and I think it does require some analytics to really maybe uncover stuff that could be subtle to the human eye. So
explain that a little more, Ben. So tell me exactly how this works. So let's say you have an image. Does it work with MRI and PET, or is it just MRI? Explain a little bit about that and what you focused on to come across this.
Yeah, so really I was focusing on the images that we had, and they were CT images. And honestly, I think that's not uncommon for somebody to, you know, if they're seeing a geriatric doctor, or they're seeing just their practicing physician, and they're having psychological disorders, I think a CT scan is one of the things that is going to be pretty frequently suggested, that they go get an imaging of the brain, and CT is going to be sometimes cheaper than an MRI. So honestly, I think we were handed almost the typical imaging that people would get. And we happened to have two of them at different points in time. And so that helped a great deal to be able to see how the atrophy progressed. But even in the original image, the image at the youngest age, the atrophy was still present, and I was still able to characterize it volumetrically. And so the way it works is...
Let me ask you this, Ben. When that first image was done, was your father-in-law diagnosed at that time, or what happened? What happened with that initial image?
Start with our story.
Yeah. So this gets into the story quite a bit. So he was having some difficulty at his job. And so his employer requested that he, just get evaluated, right? And so he met with a psychiatrist, also had some counseling, and the psychiatrist recommended some imaging. And so he got an image done. The image came back normal, with, you know, there was no atrophy present, is what they just concluded that it was normal. Mm-hmm. And so then a really, really fast forward 5 years and things got worse, much worse behavioral wise.
All the classic behavioral FTD symptoms that you're used to hearing intensified.
Many, many stories in there. And where the imaging came back in was we started to get more involved, and we're realizing that we came across FTD, became aware of the disease, and then began to understand that in order to get a diagnosis, we would need to see a neurologist. And one of the things the neurologist would want to see would be imaging. Mm-hmm. So we pleaded with the geriatric doctor physician to recommend a imaging, and
scan.
Insurance wouldn't pay for it. So we paid for it out of our pocket and went and got it. And so we were in the radiologist's office. Her father had gotten the scan, and the physician came back out to us and said, I know you guys are concerned, but it's normal. I don't see anything on it. And
with my dad standing right behind him.
And so he was like, told you. And, you know, and so now it's just this huge explosion emotionally, right? We're like, oh my goodness, we've been on this. We know
thought it was FTD. It's FTD. We were sure it was FTD.
All these symptoms are aligning, right? And it's just this like crazy mind-boggling thing to have to think through. And so I had, somehow we had the presence of mind to request the CD of the scan. And so, and we happened to live an hour away from where we got the scan done. And so the whole hour drive, we were processing it. And then I was just kind of stewing about how is this possible? There must be something wrong. So then when we got home, I pulled up the images on my computer and was looking at them and looking online and just thinking, this doesn't seem quite right. So, and so that's kind of what launched the whole thing is if you're really, really looking intently and obsessing about the image, then maybe there's some stuff there that would be seen that we can't necessarily anticipate being seen regularly. And an algorithm then that is routine would be able to see some of this stuff maybe in a little more consistent manner.
Like a computer might be able to detect things that to the human eye aren't obvious at first. It was obvious to him when he studied it. The longer he studied it, the more he realized, actually, this doesn't look normal to me. But yeah, for the average clinician who's just, you know,
looking for a tumor,
cancer or a tumor or a spot on the brain, they're not looking for atrophy. That's not something that they are trained, as far as I know, to really be on the lookout for when somebody has psychiatric symptoms or what if psychiatric symptoms, you know. Yeah. So, but a computer program,
yeah, could
can
maybe
detect that.
And it wouldn't be to replace a diagnosis or anything like that, but just simply like a caution of, hey, you know, there's something here. Maybe suggest a neurologist or maybe suggest, you know, something.
Almost like an alarm detection system to alert the clinician, hey, this person is at risk for higher levels of atrophy than is normal. Maybe possibly look into, you know, a neurodegenerative condition that might cause atrophy, like FTD. So it wouldn't diagnose FTD. These computer programs wouldn't diagnose it, but it would be a fail-safe, be a safety net for radiologists, for clinicians to ensure that what happened to us, where it got missed twice, five years apart, couldn't happen, because there would be no way that it would go undetected. It might, you know, either mistakenly identify something that isn't really the cause or something, you know, there's still margin of error, but at least it wouldn't be completely unnoticed.
Yeah. And to complete the story, when the neurologist saw the scans, the neurologist that gave the diagnosis, he suggested atrophy was present in both. So
yeah,
that's
he confirmed
kind of the
that
conclusion.
Both scans did show atrophy. It's just that whoever the radiologists and the geriatric doctors were that were looking at it before, either weren't familiar with FTD or weren't looking carefully enough. We don't really know. It's probably due to just lack of awareness that was even a possible explanation for his symptoms, you know.
How did you get him to go to a neurologist after two times being told that, oh, you're normal?
Oh, that was an adventure. I think we promised him ice cream at one point.
Oh, that works. Yeah, that always works. Ice cream works wonderfully well. Yes. Yes, we should all have stock in Ben & Jerry's. Yeah.
Or McDonald's. He was very, he has a lot of short-term memory problems as well, which, you know, can be very frustrating as a care partner, but it also can play to your favor, because then he doesn't always remember that we've already taken him to the doctor before and didn't remember that we'd been dragging him, you know, over half of Indiana trying to find out what was going on.
Yeah, but we had to be pretty about actually getting a neurologist appointment. We had to be pretty firm,
resilient
about, hey, we really need to see a neurologist. And got referred that way. So, but yeah, it wasn't.
Well, at least you finally made it there. You know, and thankfully you made it to someone who could see that there was atrophy in these images. And now tell me how this fits into the medical system. When, let's say I'm a neurologist and I think that this is a great idea for seeing things that maybe I am not even able to see in the early, early stages. How do I use this?
Yeah, I think I think a neurologist would, you know, would be able to see the atrophy, right? They'd be trained heavily to be able to pick up on these things. So I think it really would probably start at a radiology department and then just a part of the routine suites of algorithms that they're already place and look at with their scans, and just incorporating this into their suite of algorithms. But I think, so I know that, you know, there are hospital systems that will have algorithms that look at these sorts of things. I don't know. It's not a consistent approach across every hospital system. Like one hospital system may vary from the other, right? And then I think also sometimes the metrics that are being looked at, I think may be a little too restrictive. Maybe it might even miss it even then, if the atrophy is just, you know, if they're looking at three standard deviations off of a mean, it might be that the mean of the metric they're looking at isn't actually like showing the location or specific to the actual region of the atrophy. And so I think there's ways that the metrics can be misleading, even if they are statistically robust for maybe a different thing. So so I do think this is a pretty tricky, I think it's a little more tricky with this type of atrophy. So,
and so they normally use algorithms, you're saying, on these images to begin with, right?
Well, I don't know that it is consistent. I think from hospital system to hospital system, you may end up where there is not an algorithm that's necessarily giving a report. But sure, for sure, in research hospital systems, they're going to have algorithms that are looking at volumetric aspects of brain images. And so just figuring out a way to make sure that the metrics they're looking at are actually handling these types of scans well. And then the ones that don't have metrics, seeing if there is a way to incorporate the these types of metrics into their everyday practice.
So how are you trying to move this into the medical system? What is your goal? If somebody said to you today, okay, I can get you X, what would X be? What do you want to see?
I would love to have more dialogue with hospital administrators, radiology departments, neurology departments, and have some of these conversations about, I have test scans, right? So we could even do some sort of an audit or something like that to say, would this be caught? Would this be flagged with your system in your hospital network?
Yeah, like if this patient walks through the doors of your hospital, would your radiology department be able to properly catch the fact that there was atrophy, or would it be missed? And if it is missed, hey, let's talk about how we can solve that. AKA, let's talk about maybe some volumetric analysis scans that would help your radiologists, even if they're not familiar with, you know, brain atrophy conditions. It might be able to assist them in making sure that it doesn't get missed and improve your hospital's track record of proper diagnosis.
Which is important to them.
Yes. Well, yeah, should be, right?
Well, should be, yeah.
What everybody wants.
would it work on other things besides the volume of the brain, or is this, do you think that this is just for brain scans?
I mean, so vision algorithms are phenomenal. And the last decade has seen just an incredible advancement of these types of algorithms. So there are just so many things that you can do with vision algorithms. I think I really do, you know, there's everything from this, you know, more simple volumetric stuff where you're counting pixels all the way to, and classifying pixels all the way to maybe, you know, machine learning things, right? Where it's almost a intelligence that is being made to some degree. Mm-hmm. So there's just a whole host of things that have really become accessible and a lot easier to explore and try than they ever have been. And so I think it's an exciting time to be talking about this stuff. And yeah, I really do think there's a lot of ways that that brain images could be used and explored with these types of algorithms. And, you know, much smarter people than me are researching these techniques, you know, to the nth degree. And I think one thing that sometimes, is unique, I think, about our approach is we have a very maybe pragmatic and patient oriented or diagnosis journey oriented bias, right? Where we're like, well, you know, we had kind of an okay CT scan. It really wasn't that high resolution, right? And that was the thing that showed atrophy, right? So, you know, whereas I think some of the really, really on the edge algorithms are going to want to be used and explored on much higher quality imaging and, right, you know,
PET scans.
PET scans and things like that. So,
Because like usually when we're talking to FTD researchers, the vast majority of them are working with MRI or PET level scans. And that's fantastic, right? Like that's what you want. You want the patient to have access to that level of diagnostic care. But in our experience, the reality is that those scans are very hard to get approved by insurance. They're much more expensive, especially if you do end up having to pay for it out of pocket. And in our experience, both personally and then with like the families that we've talked to that have been affected, it is much more common even still for FTD families to receive CT scans than it is for them to receive these higher level brain scans. So that's why I think we focused, why Ben wanted to focus his efforts
MRI,
originally on that.
You can do volumetric analysis on
and it
MRI
would work on
MRI
too. So. We just don't want to discount. We want it to also work on CT scans because that is where the patient journey often begins, at least for in our experience.
Yeah. And the other really insightful feedback was, you know, well, we're developing blood tests to figure this out. But I think there even you may run into some hurdles because somebody has to know what to test for, right? It wouldn't just be, so with a rare dementia, I'm not sure that panel would include a screening for, you know, a rare dementia. Mm-hmm. So I still think imaging has a place in the future for this diagnosis journey. And
especially, you know, we keep thinking about, you know, all these teaching centers have all these tools or the PET scan, the SPECT scan, you know, all these high things that they can use that better determine a diagnosis. But let's face it, most people don't live there. And most mm-hmm. people that have somebody going wacko on them, you know, like we all have had, you know, when we go, what is wrong with you? You've changed. And we approach the first doctor we usually approach is someone that's our primary care.
Yes.
And if the primary care says, well, let's just do a CT scan. Let's see if anything shows up.
Yes.
Exactly.
So that is what the goal is here, is to stop it at that PC and the radiologist using this algorithm can then go back to the PC and say, there's something going on with the volume of this brain, and this may need to have a neurologist look at it. So we would be not only just cutting the time to diagnosis, but the pain of going from doctor to doctor to doctor and continually making our case and thinking that we're the ones that are crazy.
Exactly.
You know, it's like doctors keep telling me everything is fine. Well, you know, must be me then. Yes. So I certainly see where that would cut down on that, the angst of a family saying, I can't believe this came back normal. Now what? Now what?
And a lot of families may not have the resilience to, if they're told that a CT scan is normal, like he was saying, they might not have either the resilience or the ability to continue down that diagnosis journey to the more doctors, to the point where they would get to a point where they would be given a blood test that would show up. Even if, you know, I know there's a lot of biomarkers for FTD, a lot of studies being done right now for biomarkers for FTD. But like you said, like a lot of them are forced to stop earlier on in the diagnosis journey where they wouldn't even have access to the blood test, that even if the biomarker studies prove effective, they wouldn't be given that test until long after it could have been caught on a CT scan.
Right. And usually that's the first go-to with a primary physician because of cost and because of insurance not paying for more expensive images.
And it's general enough where, you know, because sometimes it is an FTD, you know, sometimes it is cancer, it's a tumor, whatever. And CT scans are famous for being able to rule out the big ones, you know, and we want these atrophy diseases, FTD in particular, to be counted amongst those that would be caught at that lower level.
Yes.
Yeah. That certainly would cut down on a lot of pain and suffering from the families.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the heartbeat that we have behind it for sure.
Have you found hospitals who are willing to try this algorithm yet, or where are you in that respect?
No, I think still in the early stages on just trying to connect with people that are out there and that would be willing to dialogue about it.
Or give us bigger sample sizes to test the.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, we were blessed in being able to have longitudinal images. And I think, you know, that often wouldn't be the case. And all we have are those longitudinal images. So, you know, confirming that this type of thing would work for many more types of situations would be very beneficial. So
what kind of roadblocks are you seeing, Ben?
Well, he doesn't work for a research hospital. Yes. He's not in academia.
He's in the industry. So yes, this is like in my evenings and weekends when I'm not, you know, wrangling a couple kids or trying to help wrangle some kids.
Hey, look, Apple came out of a campus dorm, for God's sake, you know, big things can come out of little places.
Yes.
So is that your biggest pushback when you try to talk to institutions and say, we think if we had a bigger sample that this would make a difference, and can you work with us? Is the pushback part of the fact that, well, who are you?
It's not a pushback.
It is something we've heard.
yeah. I think, you know, I'm not part of a research institute or university, right? And I'm not on staff at university. So yeah, I think for anything that would be like an NIH grant or something like that, it would most definitely need to be associated with a more official
academia institution. Focus, not industry focused.
And then any other types of grants or other types of funding would have to be super grassroots, and which is great, but you still don't really have the buy-in from the hospital institutions then at that point. So
then you have funding, but not buy-in.
Yeah. I think the roadblocks really are just being stuck at getting a connection for a hospital system that would
take a chance
that we could dialogue with. So,
or partner, do you think have that kind of buy-in?
Yeah.
Do you think that a hospital system would have to be something like a research center that, or not? Are you more interested in looking at a hospital system that just does CTs when it's ordered by a primary care physician thinking something's wrong in the brain?
Yeah, I think either of those would work just to begin to learn, you know, and understand, is this truly solving the problem? Because it appears that it is. And I mean, I think The other thing that's been mentioned a few times is to us is that the early scan, the young scan, likely would not have been caught by anyone or an algorithm because the atrophy was just so minimal at that stage. And so, you know, figuring out, do you really need a longitudinal thing, or is the, if there's enough severe atrophy, is it good enough? And mm-hmm. the other, you know, there's all these complications too, right? Like what other, are they, is there alcohol abuse that's involved, right? And so that's going to have an impact. Like, so there's other things that can impact the volumetric analysis and apart from just FTD, but I think it's still, there's still a reason to see if this FTD, if these FTD scans do are caught by the system, and to just sort of pressure test, right? Mm-hmm. Like we do with financial institutions on how much equity they have, and just kind of pressure testing the system to see, would it be caught with
let's,
these types
let's
of
prove
things.
It let's give us a chance to prove that it works.
So basically you're just looking for a hospital system that'll take a chance and say, would that be nearer to a large city, or would you not care where it was? I would think a larger city would see more of these scans though, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think a sample size, I'm, you know, as a data analyst, I'm always going to say more data is better. So
more sample size is better.
Yeah. So a greater sample size would be better for sure.
But anything is better than what we have right now, which is not much. So yes. We'll start anywhere.
Yes.
And will you be working on this algorithm to do more or better, or do you feel that where it is now is what it is?
Where it is now, it definitely, it has the capabilities that would detect atrophy. So, and you know, I think I definitely there's things I would like to do with it for sure. If it would be, you know, add more capabilities to it. Yeah. You know, segmenting different regions and looking at specific atrophy in specific regions and those types of things, and really studying more about how these standard deviations do vary as atrophy is occurring. And so there's a bunch of things I would love to do with it, but yeah,
it's functional, but it would be fun to explore what other functions he could add if we had a larger sample size.
So
basically what our listeners are, because we have listeners that are not just FTD families, we have professionals that listen to the podcast as well. So for anybody out there, what would be your plea to them?
Reach out to us.
Yeah, reach out to us. But if they are aware, you know, really dig into their algorithms, to their metrics that they're using mm-hmm. to scan, to ensure atrophy is not occurring. Because I think there's weaknesses in those metrics. I really think that there's some systemic weaknesses in how those metrics are constructed and how they're applied, especially for FTD scans. And I think that there's better ways where we can be serving this community better by improving those metrics. And they're not hard metrics too. And I think that's the really, really big thing is these are simple tweaks. It's not rocket science, right? It's
data science, but not rocket science.
They really are, I think, some pretty simple tweaks that can be made. So it just needs some exploring and some verifying. So
maybe larger public hospitals would be a good target. Would that be a good target? A large public hospital, like here in Atlanta, Grady is our large public hospital. And, but they also have a neurology department, and they also have what we have here in Georgia. It's called the Georgia Memory Net, which they have neurologists that have been trained by cognitive neurologists at Emory to be able to diagnose all dementias. And it's across the state. There are 5 locations for the Georgia Memory Net, and they're all at someplace like Grady. I mean, Grady is the biggest, obviously, because it's here in Atlanta, but we have them across the state. So even somebody like Georgia Memory Net having a contact, you know, to see what is going on, because they also work with the primary care physician. The primary care physician is who refers to the Georgia Memory Net when they're thinking that something may be wrong. Mm-hmm. So that might be the type of system you're looking at, is what I'm hearing. Does that sound right?
Yeah. I think definitely that sounds like exactly the type of situation where this could be really helpful and be vetted out some. That would be really, really, that'd be great. That'd be amazing.
Yeah. So I think if anybody has any connections to large public hospitals, or I'm thinking now about Georgia Memory Net, where I have connections, maybe we can do something to move this forward and cut down on this time that, you know, when you go to a primary care and they say, well, let's eliminate that you don't have a brain tumor, and they do that CT scan, and we can use this algorithm to then say, oh, there might not be a brain tumor, but there's something going on with the volume of that brain. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that that would cut down significantly, would also help the neurologists, because then when that person was referred to them, they'd have much more solid ground to say, there's been atrophy here. Let's look at what's causing it. You know, so I think that they'd be a step ahead even at the neurology level if they got a CT scan that's been through the algorithm saying we have a volume issue here.
And even if that makes sense? Yeah, even if it doesn't turn out to be FTD, I mean, yeah, you would think like that would be really valuable for neurologists no matter what the diagnosis ends up being, to be aware that there's atrophy going on. You know, there's just so many applications that we can think of where it would be helpful.
Yeah.
So, anything else you guys want to add, either about the Hotshot Challenge or now tell me the name of your algorithm again?
We're calling it the Algernon Project. So
and explain while you're calling it the Algernon
Project. Yeah, Flowers for Algernon. So it was a book written, you know, when all the superhero comics were starting to get written after World War II in the 50s. And it was about when people used to dream about curing things like mental illness. And I think the dream has been revived some recently, and so that's awesome. But it's a story about somebody who had a mental illness and then a cure, and how that played out. So,
although we want our project to have a much happier ending than the book did.
Yes. Yes.
Well, right now, we have a hard enough time getting a diagnosis. Let's not even begin to talk about the cure yet.
Start there. Well, for any of your listeners are present on social media, we do have an Instagram account that we keep fairly active, which is just at Algernon Project. We also have a LinkedIn company page that you can follow there for kind of more of the technical updates or company news.
I'll put that information in the description of our podcast here. So make sure you get all that information to me so that when people look at the podcast description, they will see how to contact you if there's an interest in reaching out to you, either for the Hotshot Challenge or for the Algernon Project.
And while you're at it, come follow the FTD Hotshot Challenge, especially Instagram and Facebook is where we're most active for Hotshot Challenge. But yeah. Algernon Project for Algernon, and then for FTD Hotshot Challenge, just at FTD Hotshot Challenge. So,
well, thanks.
Sorry, I had to get my social media plug in there.
thanks for talking to the person that hated math and actually making sense to him. So that's a big thing, because I hate math. If I had not had a boyfriend during geometry, I would have never made it out of that class. So thank you again for joining me, and we'll hope that you get a lot of activity on this, and it's passed around. So once again, listeners, please pass this around to anybody that you feel may benefit from hearing all this information. And we'll thank you again, Ben and Carrie. Thank you for joining me. And thank you all for listening. And we'll talk to you next time when we have another exciting topic to go over. We'll see you then.